the record, I'm going to ask the clerk to do the roll call and maybe wind up one short, but that one person hopefully will join us.
Yes, so please indicate your presence when I call your name. We'll start with Chairman Doug Chafee.
Present.
Supervisor Wagner.
Here.
James Vanderpool. Scott Stiles.
Here.
Paul Wyatt.
Here.
Sue Parks. Robert Dunn.
Here.
Randy Black.
Here.
Richard Afable. Jim Palmer. Dan Young. Jack Twan. AJ Patella.
Here.
George Searcy.
Here.
Marshall Moncrief. Tita Smith. Milo Pineman. District Attorney Todd Spitzer.
Here.
Matt Bates.
Here.
So at this time, we do not have a quorum. So
we're one short.
We are still one short, yes.
All right. Well, then, if we may, let's move on to item three. At that point, I'd like to know if there are any public commenters who are present who'd like to make any comment. We are having an in-person meeting, so it will not be something over the internet by way of especially must be here to comment. Do we have anyone in our audience who'd like to make a comment on the item, which is Office of Care Coordination Update, which is our Homelessness Action Plan overview? Seeing no one, if you go ahead, please.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for attending. So in follow-up to our previous discussions around HAP Round 3 funding, HAP standing for Homeless Housing Assistance and Prevention Program funding, we wanted to bring back the proposed funding for review from for the commission and give a status update on where we are at on the application process. The Homelessness Action Plan is a requirement by the state for both the COC and the county to apply for HAP Round 3 funding. So here in Orange County, four jurisdictions get HAP funding: the county, the COC, the cities of Santa Ana, and the city of Anaheim. Obviously, at the county, we oversee or we're the administrative entity for the county portion of it and the COC portion. The county and the COC, we will be submitting a joint homelessness action plan. And when we previously brought the action plan or the announcement by the state that a homelessness action plan is going to be required for state funding, the governor announced this late last year. The initial announcement spoke more of a larger homelessness action plan that a community needed to fill out and use that action plan to really plug into every state funding opportunity. They also said that more details were to come. So in the last couple of months, we got those additional details. And essentially, what the state said was that they narrowed the focus of the homeless action plan to be solely applicable for HAP Round 3 funding, and that the goals and solely applicable to the goals and specific intentions of that HAP Round 3 funding. So here at the county, the Office of Care Coordination is contracted with Homebase, a technical consultant, to help develop the Orange County Homelessness Action Plan that will be used for both the COC and the county. The plan requires essentially three things are included: a local landscape analysis, an identification of the numbers of individuals and families served, including demographic information, and then identification of all the funds, including state and federal, that are being utilized to address homelessness in the community. A lot of this information the state is providing us, so as I go through the slides, we'll identify the exact information that we're using. But as we go through, I just want to sort of mention this homeless action plan is, as the state has described it, is really a prescribed plan. So it's really a plug and play template that they require us to fill out. The Homeless Action Plan, like I said, requires goals and strategies, and really they're specific to things we would expect: reducing the number of people experiencing homelessness, becoming homeless for the first time, increasing the number of people exiting out of our system into permanent housing, and reducing the length of time that people are experiencing that homelessness. These metrics are all aligned with HUD's system performance metrics that the COC is already completing, and it evaluates. So we'll be able to use these metrics and goals on better serving those that are experiencing homelessness. So this essentially, the metrics that the state are asking for are very similar to the metrics that the federal government has asked for quite some time. So as we waited to get those metrics, we had some idea of what they were asking, since we've been providing this to the federal government for quite some time. As we've been developing this plan with Homebase over the last several months, we've hosted several listening sessions with various groups to ensure that we're informing and meeting with stakeholder groups across the county who interact with this population. Specifically on March 24th and March 30th, we hosted joint listening sessions that included members of this commission and members of the COC, where we received a good amount of feedback. We had asked for their input and their next steps related to prevention, outreach, rapid rehousing, shelter, and permanent housing, and how we should incorporate their feedback into our broader application. Additionally, we asked for their immediate feedback on the budget, and we made adjustments, which we'll be reflecting on the next slide as we share that budget. Mm-hmm. Finally, as we look at our timeline here, the Homelessness Action Plan requires that, and the state requires that three bodies, at least for us, three bodies review this update. One being here today at the commission, the second being our Continuum of Care Board, which will happen on the 27th, a week from today, and then finally our Board of Supervisors on June 27th. All right, so above you see the proposed funding breakdown of the combined, this is a combined COC and county tranches, half round three. Funding is broken down into state-defined eligible activities. As you can see here, the activities are defined in street outreach and engagement. We as a community have decided to budget $4 million to really focus on outreach and, more importantly, care coordination, which aligns with the Care Plus program and several other county initiatives to ensure that folks who are experiencing homelessness are having coordinated care and treatment as they receive services here in our county. Prevention dollars, this particular bucket is one that is reflective of the feedback that we receive, both by the commission members and the COC. As we originally presented this budget in the listening sessions, we didn't have $1 million budgeted to this line. We heard from the community that they believe, and we believe, that prevention is an important pillar, and we've added funding into that bucket. Rapid rehousing, this is, as we look at half round three funding, one of the things I think that's important as we consider this particular grant funding is we as a county are coming up on a handful of funding cliffs from previous state or existing state grants. As we all know, a silver lining of COVID was that there was an abundance of resources that have been provided. Well, June 30th, 2022 is when a handful of those grants are expiring. And in order for us to continue to provide services at the level that we have been, this funding is playing a vital role in that. And rapid rehousing is a really good example of that. Additionally, we put another $1 million into service coordination as the community thought we needed to further coordinate within our community and ensure people are continuing to access services at the right place in the right time. On the next slide, we'll see here the breakdown of the two budgets, the two different budgets for both the COC and the county. Essentially, the last slide you looked at, like I said, is a combination of the $19-plus million for both tranches. This year breaks down, which funding amounts coming out of the COC's tranche and which one's coming out of the county's tranche. Here is where I'd like to pause to hear, I guess, from the commission any feedback or thoughts, especially for those that were a part of the listening sessions. I think it would be helpful to hear.
Do we have any comments from board members? Any questions? I invite the audience if anyone from there has a question as well.
I have a question. So, is there, can you speak to the degree of coordination that also existed between Anaheim and St. Anna's, the other funding entities? Are they working together in terms of what they're applying for? Or is there a place where we can go to see what they're?
Yeah, so their plans, we have been meeting with, we've met with both the City of Santa Ana and the City of Anaheim. We, as you can see, we are not applying jointly with them, but we are making sure that, there isn't an overlap and there's a coordination there. In order to get greater detail on their particular plans, you'd have to reach out to those cities.
Question?
Yes.
Could you discuss, I see we're discussing later on shelter, but I'd like to distinguish between shelter and permitted housing.
Absolutely.
The discussion for years has been about permitted supported housing. There's not very much money in that tranche. Super expensive. I'm not sure I'm convinced we're ready for it and we have it. Could you just at least put something, could you at least explain what you have in terms of is rapid rehousing, that's not permanent housing, right? So what are we doing in terms of permanent housing, and have we, as the Board of Supes or any other entity, made a decision about the commitment to permanent housing?
So in specific to the Office of Care Coordination and these, the dollars that we spend around permanent housing. So Project Home Key that the state has been funding for the last two rounds, our office has helped support those applications through HAP Round 1 and HAP Round 2 dollars, specifically around the operational budget. Now, the OCCR and the Housing and Community Development Department, who takes the lead around development of permanent supportive housing, has also, they can speak better to the capital dollars and the gap funding that's been focused on permanent housing, permanent supportive housing. The difficulty here, essentially, with this particular plan is that it's one particular grant of funding. So between other funding streams like Project Home Key, No Place Like Home, special needs housing programs, the Orange County Housing Finance Trust, that's where the county has been heavily funding permanent, affordable, and supportive housing.
I might add we're asking the legislature to provide $30 million to the Housing Finance Trust, which a lot of that kind of housing is flowing through it, and it's not all the funding that's necessary, but it closes some of the gaps. So we have our legislators seem to be unanimous in Lamar County in supporting that. And so there are a lot of different pockets, and this is just one of them, really. So
I guess my last question is, The one that you're talking about that is in front of us now, is it integrated sufficiently so that when you get to these next steps that people are ready? My biggest concern forever, I'm not trying to open a can of worms, is that when we saw when we rented the motels after clearing the riverbed, they got trashed. And I'm not really convinced yet that people are ready to go from the street into a permanent home and be able to take care of it and everything else that goes along with it. So I'm asking, are we doing these steps from the street to some kind of temporary housing? Are we preparing people to go into permanent supportive housing and be able to take care of it?
Yeah, absolutely. The funding here and our overall efforts, when we talk operational dollars, a large portion of those operational dollars go to case management, to mental health and substance use specific case management in the shelters and also in the permanent supportive housing. You know, I wasn't here during the clearing of the riverbed and can't speak specifically to the motels, but I have heard similar feedback to what you had mentioned. Permanent supportive housing is successful because of that support piece, bringing people in and working, having the supports around them to work through and to deal with day-to-day issues such as maintaining the particular unit. So these dollars, and I know we have in here specifically, there's one specific line item in here, the delivery of permanent housing and innovative housing solutions. So we only have about $2.3 million in that bucket for that particular claim for HAP Round 3, but we used our entire HAP Round 2 funding stream to help those specific services in our home key projects, the two in Stanton. Yeah. This is a snapshot. So things that were heavily funded previously, where we don't need the immediate need, aren't necessarily represented in here. But to your point, yes, it is a coordinated effort.
All right. Perfect. Thanks so much for your answers.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other comments or questions? I would ask this, how are these funds actually paid out? Are we doing RFPs or what within the COC and the...
Yeah, for the most part, these funds will be, when they're allocated, when the budget's finalized, they will hit the ground through most likely an RFP process and a contract with the county with a nonprofit provider.
Okay.
Dr. Chow has a question.
Yeah, I see Dr. Chow.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. I think it's good to ask the pertinent questions, but I think the answer to that is the next slide, where it speaks to the categorical requirement of activity we have to spend this funding on.
Michelle, for comment.
And have any public requests to speak?
No, we do not have any requests on this item.
No, I know the hotel thing is trashing because we had to pay for it. So
I had to
vote on that. And that was not knowing anything about the people coming in, get them out of the riverbed, get them there. And then the hotel motel they were in, it just run like a hotel motel. Sometimes the manager can stay overnight, you know, and so it's not the same as the supportive housing that we're trying to provide. And they're not going to go there directly. I think when we look at going through the shelter, the big clog there is we don't have a place for people to go next. And so that's they've been through the shelter, the navigation, and some of the supportive services they've had. I think then hopefully they're ready for that next step.
Mm-hmm.
And your point was well taken. Well, this isn't an action item, so if we can go on to the next non-action item, which is the item 4, is a review.
Absolutely, and I think, Mr. Spitzer, as we go through this framework, it'll speak more and more to the comments and questions you had. So, as we continue to work through our pillars as a commission. Today we bring back the shelter pillar for final review to the commission, which will be included in our broader plan reflecting all of the work completed around these pillars. Before we get into it, I always like to first get things sort of kick-started with the definition and the goals. As we've done with each pillar, we really want to make sure that we sort of set the table right off the bat. We presented this definition and these goals last meeting. As The working group met between meetings, and I'll talk a little bit about the groups that it met with as well. These definitions state, they approved the test of the listening sessions, but specifically providing temporary residence providing safety and protection from exposure, offering a safety net at a time of crisis for those experiencing homelessness. And the goal is, I think, most important in this step, which is that first step towards achieving housing and financial stability. Emergency shelter and navigation centers are generally considered to be entry points to a broader array of those key support services with linkages to long-term programs and permanent housing. So, as you saw in the original presentation to this, and you'll see more today, really the group is talking about how shelter is an entry point, but it's really a forward moving exercise as well. So before we go deeper into that framework, I'd like to highlight that the ad hoc group met with several groups in between our last meeting to now to really hear feedback from three specific groups of experts and to hear their feedback on our particular pillars. The first group that we met with was Jessica Kubicki, who works for the Housing Collective in Connecticut. And she also presented on the best practices related to emergency shelters in Connecticut. So we utilized her as that national or outside expert. We then met with Friendship Shelters, most of you know, who operate a shelter down in Laguna Beach, and also a wide array of services for individuals experiencing homelessness. And they, at that presentation, we also met with an individual who had lived experience who accessed their services, but is also now currently working with Friendship Shelter. So, as we go through and look at these best practices and final framework, you'll see in blue is where we plugged in additions created based on feedback from the different providers and individuals that we met with, plus the working group's thoughts. Throughout our feedback, we heard that it's a true emphasis and true level of high importance is creating a safe place for individuals and families to come while they're working on their housing plans actively with their case manager. So we heard a lot about, from not only our experts, but also our experts here on the commission, that it's really, and we'll see that some parallels on the permanent housing side as well, but it's not just services, and it's not just a physical space that you need to provide, it's both, providing a safe physical space while ensuring that the services are there for people to access and really focus on their journey towards permanent housing. So as we see, the goals of these best practices will be put into a set of recommendations, as we said, so that the county can have these as a guide for when, as we implement and create new ideas across the shelter system. So you can see some of the feedback we received, things that we've been hearing both here at the commission and outside the commission. The importance of tailored, focused case management. Our experts really emphasized the importance of creating an environment that celebrated each person obtaining housing, sending providing a positive reinforcement, removing any imposed maximum length of stay, while requiring that people remain housing focused. So really, a matching between lowering thresholds, essentially meaning accepting people the way they are, but at the same time, as they enter in, surrounding them with services and ensuring that not only the individual, but most importantly, the staff that's working with them is extremely housing focused and understands that the need is to continue to be working towards housing and that this is not a landing spot. you know, yet again, as we sort of see here, as we had discussions with these groups, for example, around staffing and the importance of staffing, we heard more global input about staffing and other areas that we felt were important to include in this slide deck. Essentially, this slide deck is used, and it continues to be used as sort of that framework. But as we finish with our next commission meeting, we'll use all of the feedback that we hear, both in the commission and out of the commission, to create a document that incorporates all of this feedback to send up to the Board of Supervisors. And then finally, around our shelter principles and commitments, there was really, you know, a point we heard over and over again, and it's highlighted here in blue, and when we added that first piece is that it's incredibly important to continue to emphasize the need to divert individuals away from the shelter system, as that's the most effective way to assist households out of the homeless system of care. You know, ensuring that shelters are utilizing every option available to that individual is incredibly important, and that when they hit your front doors, that you're really looking to see if there's other places or resources within that person's circle that can help them end their homelessness quickly, instead of potentially a longer stay that's focused on utilizing whether it's permanent supportive housing or a voucher. So, and then finally, as we do it at the end of each pillar, since we are going through a very specific exercise, and while going through that exercise, often different points and important feedback is brought to the table that might not necessarily fit into this framework, but should be discussed in the future. We create a list at the end of each one of these pillars to list that those areas where we should consider future consideration for discussion and further analysis. So, you know, a lot of the discussion that we heard and a lot of the questions that came out of our discussion were asking about how we analyzing shelter access as a system. How can we, you know, better increase access by lowering barriers? What does that mean as a community? Reasons for reassessing requirements for entry into the shelter system, and then exploring an implementation of potentially a by name list for outreach shelters and permanent supportive housing providers to work together when coordinating services for individuals, and being really targeted name by name on ensuring that the system is providing that individual with the best, most coordinated level of care. That essentially ends my presentation for the shelter pillar.
Questions? Discussion? Comments? Yes, Chief Gunn.
How would this look practically implemented? Like, how do we hold the providers to this framework that is being suggested? And then at some point, there's going to have to be community input too. I mean, I don't make policies, but I watch all the house meetings since I'm there. And most of the feedback from communities as you're trying to implement these shelters in your communities is higher barriers. They want tons of barriers placed on shelters, and this is advocating for lower barriers. And how do we make that synergy happen, or is there a way that we could help explain why lower barriers could work given the right amount of regulation, or I call it accountability? How do we hold the shelter providers accountable to doing what we're asking them to do or what's been identified here, and then tell that story to the community so that we don't meet resistance from those who live near these places? You know what I mean? Because I find that that's always the tug of war that happens.
I think I appreciate that question. When we talk about lower barriers, it's often about lower barriers to entry. And I think what often gets interpreted to that is also lower expectations around behavior, around security, and that's those are two separate discussion points, and that's where I think we're able to marry. You know, we want to make sure we're serving the individual that people are seeing out on their street corner, and we want to accept them in. In order to accept them in, we need to accept them for who they are at that moment. Now, in regards to maintaining and operating a safe shelter that is also a good neighbor, that doesn't mean, although an individual might be experiencing mental illness and not addressing it in the traditional form, or getting, you know, or is sober or has come in after going to a detox program, that doesn't mean that we don't hold that individual to a specific standard of, hey, you need to be a good neighbor. There's no violence in this shelter. There's no drugs or alcohol in the shelter. And then the important part is just because you lower the threshold doesn't mean that the moment you get them in the door, you now surround them with a gigantic amount of services so that they have access to that. So I think that's where the discussion and where you're... I think you articulated well where the conflict happens in that discussion, but how it plays out is in the details. So.
But words do matter, and these are public documents. Yeah. And the words we use, I mean, he's at council meetings. A lot of us here are in the public all the time, confronting the public. And the lower barriers said mean something in the community without a bunch of education and explanation. So are these like terms of art in grants and statutes, or are these words people are picking that we can somehow, we can make more malleable so that we actually don't leave people with the wrong impression, like lower barriers means less accountability? I mean, the chief's point is extremely well taken.
Absolutely. So I think to your comment, we need to do, the feedback I'm hearing from you is we need to do a better job explaining that out. I think...
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I think it's a bad choice of words. I don't like lower anything.
Okay.
That's just me, because it's too hard to explain.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean by our choice of words and articulating it. I think sometimes we're guilty of lower barriers in the homeless service community. People understand exactly what we're talking about, but to your point, out in the community, lower barriers mean something very different. So I appreciate that feedback, and we can make sure that potentially bringing back the framework with more, like you said, malleable language that explains our exact intent when we utilize that.
And the last piece of that, my question too, is the accountability piece to the providers, because we can make this the edict or the, hey, this is the best practice in your business based on all this feedback. But if they're unwilling to do it or don't do it, what levers do we have to, because I think the point about the low barriers is the access to service. When we are doing street outreach, and you would know this, Matt, too, and you meet someone on a Friday night at 10 p.m. and you tell them to come back Monday morning at 8 because there's a barrier to entry, they're not going to be there by and large.
Yeah.
Some do. But by and large, they're not there, and we miss that person, and we miss the opportunity, and we shouldn't.
Yeah.
And so how do we make it part of the fabric of the shelter system that we're helping in part fund to ensure that that doesn't happen?
From our office, there's two pieces. One is the language we put in our contracts, and that's where the malleable language is very specific in the contracts. Speaking about, for your example, intakes can't happen between 10 and 2 p.m. only 3 days a week. You know, lowering barriers, that's an example of lowering barriers, is having an ability to intake people 24/7 or a larger period of time. So that's one piece. And then all of the shelters that the county funds and operates are required to operate under the standards of care, which is an agreement or a standards that was developed out of the settlement agreement with the Catholic workers that goes very into detail expectations on shelters. So our office, for at least the shelters we operate and oversee, are monitoring those shelters on those criteria on a regular basis.
Yeah. Paul, Mr. Wyatt, would you go ahead, please?
I have a Just a couple things. First of all, the presentation is, is summary wording of our last working group meeting. So, and there's a couple things that I think are still don't quite fit together. I would just want to. So on the plan overview, the very last point of the plan overview says increase successful placements from street outreach. I think that's one of the things that we have to, and by successful placements from street outreach, that means successful placements in housing. It's one of the things that we are looking to measure that goes directly from the street into housing. So that is that's a bit of a discrepancy from our objective statement, our goal statement here of shelter is a first step and or an entry point, right? Because that's one of those items where we need to be clear that you don't have that it is not necessary, or clear it is one way or the other. Is it clear that it is necessary to go through a shelter before you can be housed, or is it? Should we make it clear that that is not the only way to get from the street to housing is to go through a shelter? Right? I mean, we have the wording such that we're not clear. Now, in our discussions, we said that it was not necessary to go through a shelter to go to housing. I think that's important if that's the case for us to be clear about. The version we've put in here, again, another somewhat nebulous term, right? Because I think the statement that came out of our discussion that was most helpful to me was, if you can establish the last place the person felt safe and supported, is where that was, and whether you can make that connection, whether you can rebuild that connection back and divert them back to where the last place that they were safe and supported was, that would be your best option. That's the most likely where you would get the recovery. And I think both of our shelter consultants made that clear that that's the, if you can do, every time you can do that, that's a big win. Second assumption, and housing first thing that came up out of there, is there's a starting assumption that everybody's ready to be housed. And that, Mr. Spitzer brought up that, I mean, that's a question. And then in those cases where you decide that, for whatever the circumstances are, that's not true, then you need to figure out what would have to change for that person to be housed and start that plan. We talk a lot about being housing first, taking the housing first approach, which is that, you start with the assumption that they can be housed and then back off of that if necessary. We need to really make it clear how that fits into our overall scheme of the shelters here. With that, we basically said, again, and coming back to the first steps, that the statement was that shelter is to be used when there's no other safe environment available. So it is not your first step. It is a step when you don't really have another safe environment to move the person to, that you would move them to a shelter. Again, we don't make that as clear as I think we could as we came out of those statements, and I think that's worth revisiting. And then the other point, in terms of coming back to, Mr. Dunn's statement, Chief Dunn's statement, is basically when you enter the shelter, we need to set the expectations that you're now, then one of your most initial steps, which we do cover later, is to start working on the plan of how you will exit the shelter. Right? So all of those, we need to refine our language if we really are going to support those things and make it clear in our overall plan here. Because that's basically the best practices advice we got there that we were fitting in, and I just want to make sure that we stay a lot of that later in our slides, but all of it doesn't flow smoothly into delivering that message. I think it would be helpful to deliver that.
Well, thank you for that. Are there other comments? George, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Chafee. I just wanted to go back and camp for just a second on Chief Dunn's remarks. We basically start this by prefacing my experience a couple of weeks ago at a neighborhood just outside of Orange County where 130 angry residents turned out to oppose a permanent housing project based on a complete misunderstanding of all of the concepts. And this is a, this was, for those of you that don't know, there was a by rights component to certain kinds of housing projects. Now, you are allowed to, cities are allowed to, or not able to oppose certain kinds of housing projects if they meet the zoning overlay that exists on the site as it is. So I would just say, Doug, this is bringing, and Paul, this brings me back to like all of our phases of the pillar, the study of the pillars that we're looking at, because if there's one thing that creates a drag on the whole execution of the solutions and the strategies, implementation, it is that there is not even agreement about what these concepts mean that we're discussing here. And we're talking inside baseball to us, so to your point, Mr. Spitzer, like we all, those of us in the field every day, we know what this means. But I would say public officials in all regards, appointed, elected, say what you will, there is a very poor understanding or no common understanding of what these concepts means, and there is no process by which that common understanding is being addressed. And so I think, if I'm just sitting here thinking, wow, where could that conversation land that does transcend jurisdictions and organizations and geographic boundaries in Orange County, if that's one thing that could come out of this, is a more unified conversation about what what shelter means, what permanent housing means, what interim housing means, that would not be a lost value conversation, and I think have no tangible benefits in the long run. Right down to the extent of what are the expectations of shelter providers, because the county's not the only one that runs shelters. There are so many jurisdictions that have their own interpretation of what they want in their jurisdiction, which makes it very difficult on shelter operators, like, to figure out, well, Fullerton wants this, but Glen Park wants this, and the county wants that. So that's just the thought I have as a result of this conversation.
Okay, thank you. If I may make a comment, I think there's two different issues here. One is the issue of what language do you use when you go for a grant. You have to kind of mold yourself into that grant speak and what the state wants you to say to get the grant, and the public side, where you need to massage your words so that it's a greater understanding. And taking into that what Todd said about the lower barriers, I just want to, instead of saying increase access by lowering barriers, perhaps we would just say increasing access to shelter. That might be a better way of saying it, if we just do that. And I think the whole experience has to be an individual holistic one as people come into the shelter, because they're all different and everybody needs to go through an assessment. And when do you need to go to the next step, or can you go to the next step, is the services that are needed there. As I remember when I went on the so-called sanitation board, which I thought was called the sewer board, I went on there, and they now call it OCSAM, you know, all this stuff. And I was a little bit familiar with the conversion of sewer water into drinking water. I didn't know much, so I said, can you tell me about the toilet-to-tap program? It was the mantra that they were using at that time. And they changed that. They found out a little bit of a stigma. So now they changed it to, no, we don't say it anymore. It's now showers to flowers. So you get into this kind of thing that is a little bit PR and marketing. And also, how do you better explain what you're trying to do? And so I think there's some of that. So I appreciate the language does make a difference. We have to separate, though, when it's the grant application versus the public. And yes, there are different expectations among different public entities and the political side. So kind of getting a standard understanding, we can look at the deviations, but I think we need an understanding of our own, trying to promote these different pillars. And that's part of the idea of the pillars. Have the pillars going to study it more, come up with some better solution. I'm sorry, Paul, I cut you off.
No, I just want to say, I mean, what George said was, I thought, right on, and, you know, and Doug, yeah, with the pillars and the definitions and goals, if we can't communicate a consistent message that we all can understand around this table from what these documents said, then we haven't got them there yet, right? We need to, because that really, we should come out of here with a message that not only that, first of all, that we all agree and understand. Actually, we don't all have to agree, we all have to understand, right? But also, we need to take it to, you know, to be able to take it to a larger audience than here, where they're not working on this all the time, and not have them totally confused by what this says. So I think, in terms of getting these pillars right, that I agree with Chairman Chafee and Mr. Searcy, that is what we should be attempting to do out of these discussions.
Thank you. Any more comments?
Just have a quick amendment. There's a big difference between, and I'm glad these gentlemen brought this up. I hadn't thought about it before. There's a difference between a best practice and a public policy decision about what you're going to do. If a best practice is to go around the shelter and go into some kind of housing at all costs, it sounds like the last resort is a shelter, but we'll use it if we have to. That may not be the policy question, and I'm not sure I understand that looking at this document. If we said as a county, hey, wait a minute, irrespective of what your needs are, you are going to process from the street at least through a shelter for some period of time for an assessment, say, for example, by the professionals before in order to determine if you're ready, what your housing needs are, the Kids Act, whatever. This document, I don't see that addressed. I see best practice, and I see shelter as a possibility. But this is going to keep moving forward on the conveyor belt towards the Board of Supervisors. And so I thought, do we have a responsibility to frame that at this stage before it moves on to the next group? Because I don't know what the answer is. Are we going to follow the best practice? Or are we going to say, as a public policy decision, there needs to be a different... We're either going to adopt that, or we're going to take a different approach. I'm not the expert. I don't know, but is if we say that's how we're going to do it, we are making a policy decision. And I don't know if you thought about that, or if somebody thinks, no, that is a best practice. We're going to avoid shelters, or we want to use our shelters as screening entities to evaluate people's readiness to go into, say, a higher level of housing.
Thank you. Well, we have our ad hoc committee that has its work cut out for itself, and that's certainly...
Is there an opinion about that, though, today, what we should be doing as our county? Should we not be using our shelter? Our shelter should only be a last resort?
I didn't hear that. I hear that's an as-needed thing, and not something that you force people through to get to housing.
Yeah.
And that's not, I think, what I'm hearing, and nor is it the practice. And in fact, to get to housing, you need more housing. That's the first problem. So if we can move on, we still don't have a quorum. Are there any public comments, Secretary?
I have not received any requests from the public to speak on this item.
Well, I would be remiss if we didn't introduce our intended new member. Mr. Kim Halchuk, would you give us an introduction as to you're going to be representing the continuum of care as our missing person for that?
Right.
You'd be the found person. If you would give us a little bit of your background. I know we can't actually vote on you today because we don't have a quorum.
Okay.
I've read that. But would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I was a little concerned about the hazing process. my name is Tim Houghton, and I'm formerly homeless. I was actually homeless here at the Civic Center between 2010 and 2015. And during that time, I kind of became active with some of the other folks that I was homeless with. And we began speaking at different Board of Supervisors meetings and at City Council in Santa Ana. And that kind of started my activism. And then I kind of grew from more of an advocate, from homeless advocate to kind of a community, what I call a community advocate. So I'm looking for solutions that benefit both people that are homeless and folks that live in our communities. And so, as you mentioned, I'm a member of the Continuum of Care Board now. I also chair a lived experience advisory committee that is formulated of people that have homeless experience that aren't necessarily on the board. But and what we do is we come up with ideas or try to kind of maybe focus on some challenges that people have getting into housing and accessing services, and we take our advice to the CLC board. And so it's kind of a new thing. We've been around for about a year. I'm the chairman of that particular committee, and things have been working out pretty well. I mean, we have some things that we're working on that we want to take to the board, but I guess, you know, mainly what I wanted to say is that I'm glad to be recognized and to be considered as a representative for this particular commission. It's been a long time that I've been wanting to maybe become more active and more involved with the COC and the Commission on Homelessness, so I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today, and I hope we get a quorum to make you official next time.
Yeah, look forward to that.
Well, the action items have to wait, as you don't have a quorum. And at this point, are there any public commenters under that category of public comment?
I have not received any request to speak for under general public comments.
All right. Well, and I don't see any people racing up here to make comments. So now I'd invite the commission members if there are any comments in general that you'd care to make.
I cut you off.
Go ahead.
All right, perfect. So we'll present here. This is our initial draft of the housing pillar. So like with every other pillar, we're going to give you the initial draft. then we're going to, the working ad hoc group created this draft prior to this meeting. We'll take feedback today, and then the working ad hoc group will meet between now and the next meeting to incorporate that feedback. Also, work with the three groups we traditionally work with, a person of lived experience in this pillar, a local expert, and a national expert, to bounce the framework off of and incorporate their feedback. So, standard framework here, we start with the definition and the goals for the housing pillar. So the definition here, we landed on stable housing is a solution to end an individual's homelessness that provides a sustainable place to live. The goal being housing programs and capacity that end a person's homelessness by providing a permanent home with supportive services to ensure stability. So as you see through the definition and the goal, we felt it, and the group felt it, important to emphasize terms like stability and sustainability. Similarly, through the description of the goal, yet again, using terms as end and permanent were incredibly important to emphasize that this isn't, a temporary permanent housing option. And then the importance that I think we've heard again here today, which is ensuring that there's supportive services to ensure sustainability. So it's not just exactly putting someone into a motel or an apartment and saying, here's the key, good luck, we're happy you got a home, but really ensuring that we're surrounding that individual with support services, understanding that support's needed through that transition. Is there any room for improvement, or does this feel like it captures the work that we're trying to achieve? I don't know if the any of the working ad hoc group members also want to chime in on this particular.
Any comments?
I know we had a long discussion about it. I'm fine moving on. As we do with each of the pillars, we try to bring data to the groups. Here, we spent a lot of time thinking about what's the best and most appropriate data to bring to this group, which is really looking at the system from the sort of 30,000-foot level. So here, for housing, we've brought two specific data points that we think is incredibly important. First, here is, as you'll see up here up on the screen, this is the results of our last three, what we call housing inventory counts. HUD requires annually a count that reports up to them a jurisdiction's current inventory of housing, and that includes permanent housing. So as you can see here, there's for each year we have three different types of housing or ways we delineate permanent housing. We have permanent supportive housing, and that dark red, the rapid rehousing. Rapid rehousing is often essentially providing an individual with a rental subsidy for a period of time so that they could go out and rent an apartment in the community, and wrapping them around with support services for a period of time as they transition in. And then other permanent housing. So fortunately, and what we've seen over the last 3 years is an increase. Largely, I think, due to a handful of efforts, and one we'll talk about in a minute, but you know, in 2019 we were at 3125. That was our inventory. And since and in 2021 we increased 554 units. Now, our housing inventory is done early in the year. We do a housing inventory when we do a point in time count. We do that housing inventory count alongside it. So in an ideal world, I'd have the 2022 HIC, what we call a housing inventory count, and I believe that that would show an increase, those results aren't final yet. And then we thought it was incredibly important to speak about the housing funding strategy that was adopted and received and reviewed by the board back in 2018, which focuses on creating 2,700 units of permanent supportive housing by the end of June 2025. Here on this chart, you'll see, which is taken from the Housing Trust Fund's website, that currently we have we're at 1,304 units in our pipeline, with a little under 400 complete, 350 in progress of finding funding, and then an additional 506, a little under 560 that is under contract. So this, this here at the county is a arguably the main goal and driving goal that is that we're striving for when it comes to developing permanent supportive housing. The best way we're tracking it. All right. As we move into best practices, there's essentially four categories that the Working Ad Hoc Group broke down looking at best practices in permanent housing. Project design and administration, property and housing management, support services, and community. And as we work through these best practices, you'll see the difference between them, why we articulate it this way. As, you know, we talked a little bit about it when we had our shelter discussion. It's not just the services you're providing, or the physical space, or putting people in a community that will allow them to thrive, and also ensuring that them being in that community helps that community thrive. It's all of those combined. So we wanted to break them out and discuss each one separately. So when we talk about support services, you'll see here, the emphasis that, and this is where I think, yet again, the wording's incredibly important. And I really appreciate the last discussion, because I think often, as an aside, someone like myself who's in this business get frustrated, to George's point, around really good projects that we put forward where there's pushback in the community. But to the points today, are we necessarily doing a good job articulating why that's a great project? Or are we using our inside baseball terms and assuming that everyone assumes that, and when really we're wrong in that assumption? So here, we speak about services are voluntary, customized, and comprehensive, reflecting the needs of all the housing members. Voluntary, you know, I'd imagine that's a word that might grab people. I think voluntary is important, but any provider that's worth their weight knows that they need to be able to ensure that those people take those voluntary services. There's a difference between, as we know, mandatory services and voluntary services that we get everyone to utilize. Allowing people to make decisions and educating them, so it's not so much that they're getting forced upon services, but that they're educated about services and they're making their own decision. And we all know it's incredibly basic. You know, when we make a decision for ourselves, we're usually much more committed to that decision than when someone tells us to make a decision. So the primary services provider has to have an established connection to mainstream and community level resources. You know, incredibly important that, yet again, and it sort of melds into that community piece. Are we putting people in a community, in a housing project that is close to their resources? Is the service provider that's in the permanent housing project connected to the outside resources, knowing that all services that an individual has, most of them are going to happen out in the community, and it's important for that housing provider to be able to connect to those services out in the community. Staff supports tenants in developing and strengthening connections to their community, and the supportive housing project has the funding that's sufficient to provide those services to the tenants. Then we move on to community. The most successful supportive housing project does not operate in an isolation, but serves an integral role in the target community, in the larger community, I'm sorry. The housing application and screening process is part of the larger community strategy that coordinate access to housing, and that supportive housing partners connect with and support the efforts of the community stakeholders working to ensure positive institutional changes. And I think we're on to the last slide, which is speaking specifically about housing principles and commitments. So we want to emphasize the need for housing first in our community and create an atmosphere where we are able to meet the needs of the individual where they're currently living. As you see here, we go a little further into housing first. I think this is another term that has many definitions, and we as a homeless service community could probably do a better job communicating what we mean when we say housing first. You know, all people have access to housing, housing stability and permanent housing if they are provided the right supports. Housing serves as the foundation for improving quality of life, health, and mental health. That's a big portion of housing first is understanding that many of the individuals experiencing homelessness have a variety of complex issues going on in their life that has resulted in their homelessness, and that we understand that getting them housed is a key step in providing the stability that's required in their life to start going to a program regularly or to services regularly. And also on the opposite side, understanding the incredible challenge and the unlikeliness that people will be successful in addressing other issues in their life when every day they're worried about where they're going to sleep that night. And then all people have the right to self-determination, dignity, and respect. And that, yet again, goes a little bit along the lines of speaking about voluntary services. but more importantly, ensuring that we're providing access and educating people to services, and that we're creating an atmosphere that encourages folks on their own to come and engage in services. Then speaking about, you know, the group thought important to mention flexibility, voluntary support services, increasing permanent supportive housing and affordable housing options, single, the importance of a single unit occupancy, and then this last bullet here, which is reentry units for institutional to community transition. So, you know, through some of the work that's going on with OC Cares, and other forums that have really highlighted the need for individuals to have access to housing when they do access other services related to mental illness, specifically substance use. If they're going to go into detox, they're making that big step into rehabilitation, or even exiting hospitals or specifically jails, ensuring that there's access to housing for those individuals in order for them to truly be able to access the larger, often, service plan that will help, you know, improve their life. So. And then, you know, housing as a whole is our last piece. So that sums up my presentation of this. I don't know if any of the working ad hoc group members want to speak to the development of this.
I just maybe add, and given some of the feedback that we've heard today, just the recognition that, you know, housing can mean, can be a broad term as generally understood, which is maybe a little bit different than those of us who are service providers think about housing. So just to tie some of it together, like if in the shelter presentation, one of the points of feedback that was important that we got from our service providers was that the shelter should be at a standard that set expectations to what a person is likely to be able to afford on their own when they leave the shelter, right? So not lower than that or not higher than that. So in that vein, you know, from a service provider, we understand housing to mean that some of the housing options are going to be shared housing, where people are going to be, you know, sharing a room, they're going to have roommates. And that's the realistic outcome for some clients, and that's an appropriate outcome for some clients, because in the market that we're in, if everybody's waiting for a one bedroom or even a studio apartment, very often the cost of that is higher than what a person can be able to sustain. So it's not, you know, I've been in communities sometimes where people have an expectation of housing, they're thinking, they've got perceptions in their mind that are not necessarily useful. So I think as we're, one, I want to just state that we recognize that the other thing I wanted to point out, like, that might be a point of confusion, is that for some clients, permanent supportive housing with wraparound supportive services is the appropriate step. But there are also clients that will move from the shelters into self-sustaining housing. They're working as they're living in the shelters. They're earning income. They're saving money for their first and last month's rent security deposit, and they can sustain a monthly rent, but they don't have the initial amount of money that they need to get into housing, or the housing market is so tight, they keep trying, they're looking, and they can't find it. And for those clients, they won't need necessarily the supportive services. So it's not that everybody fits in the same outcome category. There is a diversity there, and I think as the ad hoc, as we look at that, from a communication standpoint, it might be useful for us to consider how we can articulate that, because I think internally as service providers, we understand that intuitively. But like George, I've been in lots of community meetings where there's lots of misunderstanding when you start talking about housing. You know, some people will be thinking of, you know, old, outdated models of government project housing. Others will be thinking of, you know, they'll say housing is home in Orange County. That looks like, you know, a single family home with a yard, and this, and it may not mean either of those things. So just to communicate what it is that we're specifically talking about, I think it's incumbent on us to get better at that articulation.
Yes, please.
Yeah,
Doug, a question. Under the Housing First model, the statement, all people have the right to self-determination. Maybe I'm going to be a little bit of a heretic, but no. There are folks who have, through conduct, perhaps given up or forfeited that right. Folks, for reasons of mental illnesses and you know, medical conditions, may not be able responsibly at this point to exercise that right. How does the Housing First model deal with what I believe are those realities?
Yeah, so I think you bring up a good point. So the example I think of is someone that needs to be 5150. And I think this is where we had a little bit of a discussion in the working ad hoc group around the shelter pillar that was sort of similar. Housing First is a set of principles. How you practice that is really what's important. I think that any practical, outreach provider or homeless service provider believes that everyone has the right to self-determination, but understands that there are situations where, like you articulated, this person at the moment is not in a position to make decisions. So I don't think I've done the greatest job particularly answering your question, but I think it's the difference between talking about the principles of our system and then how do we practice those principles. And I think there's an understanding that there is, when practicing these principles, there are different paths, and that there's not one golden lane for everyone, and that not every situation is the same, and that there are times where, there is a need for involuntary action. So,
can I make a suggestion, just dovetailing on the supervisor?
Yeah, please.
The word "all," I think. We changed the name of the commission, right? Remember, it had a different name. Any homeless by, and it was a target thing. And I think we all realize that we're putting an untold burden on ourselves, right? And it's unrealistic, so we changed the name. Honestly, the statement that Supervisor Wagner just brought up should be, people have a right, because it's a philosophical concept. People do have a right. However, there are people whose society takes that away. When you say all people, you're saying all, irrespective of other conditions that society has imposed. I would just say eliminate the word "all," yeah, and then I think you incorporate.
I think you're
point.
Probably reasonable.
I have a problem with the very first bullet.
Yeah.
All people can achieve housing stability. Not true. That's not true. I prosecuted a park ranger at Costa Mesa who ran over a homeless man. The city paid him $1 million, which in those days, this is 20 years ago, could have bought a pretty nice condo in Costa Mesa, or a nice house probably back then. He didn't want to leave the street. He wanted to live on the street, which is the bullet that we just talked about. He had the right, irrespective of $1 million, to self-determination to stay on the street. No one could force him to buy a house. I think the first bullet needs to be, it should be like this. People can achieve housing stability and permanent housing if they are provided reasonable support. Because not all people will be successful, and it's not government's responsibility to provide everything that you could imagine to keep somebody in house. Like, it's got to be reasonable. So I just think if we don't eliminate some of these "alls" and the right support, like, what's the right support? Do I have a responsibility as a taxpayer to provide whatever it takes? No, I don't think so. So I would just urge us to be really careful with our language so that we don't overpromise and we don't include like every scenario which is outside of our control. We can only help people who want to help themselves in terms of trying to control their own destiny. I don't know what the Be Well stats are on detox yet, but I know when I went to San Antonio, 65 drop-offs on average before somebody went across the hall in San Antonio into detox. 65 visits. So you can't, and I'm sure Be Well's got to be somewhat similar. So there's no way that every person who comes in for the first time to get detox at Be Well, for being under the influence, is going into detox.
Yeah.
And I know I beat this drum a lot since I've been in here about the accountability piece, but there are a lot of providers working in a lot of these spaces that we're talking about, and we're setting up these frameworks that we think are best practices for them. There really has to be, and I don't know what that looks like, and I'll throw this out there for purposes of discussion. It's not my intention to make this happen, but there's a juvenile justice commission in this county that goes through to the different departments and inspects the areas where the juveniles, you know, occupy when they're in law enforcement custody, and they produce a report on the efficacy of the agency as it relates to its encounters with juveniles. That's mandatory, happens every year. I think there should be a mechanism in this county that tests the efficacy of these service providers, because I'll sit at a council meeting and I'll hear people come up and say, I'm never going to that shelter because the service provider is awful, and there's no, and when I go to eat at a restaurant, there's a grade on the door that tells me how good that person does at cooking, right? And so I think that there's a need somehow to test, when we implement these things, to test to make sure that the providers that are receiving at least our funding in this county are meeting that measure, and if they're not, give them corrective action. If they don't, then we need to take that money and put it elsewhere to the providers who are successful. And I think there is, that comes out in here. And offering the right service right now is the key to that. And right now, there isn't anybody doing that on a day-to-day basis in our county, I don't believe.
So two things. Your feedback is well taken, and this is why we bring it forward, because we want that feedback, so thank you. In terms of the contracts in the county, I just want to be really clear. We have specific expectations and performance outcomes written in our contracts, and we evaluate those. This framework is going to help continue to craft and edit that language, hopefully, as we move forward. But there is the challenge in Orange County, especially as someone who's come into this county recently, as we all know, is that there's 34 cities, one county, and you know, a handful of private operators, especially in the shelter community. So many groups are overseeing many different services, which makes, you know, obviously it a challenge.
And what I'm saying is perhaps there could be one group that oversees those, that herds those cats, if you will, because there's I guarantee you, if they took a really hard look, we would find some areas where we could make some improvements to really get closer to achieving what we're talking about in these forums. My personal opinion and experience in my little portion of the space.
Any other feedback for our ad hoc to take back when it reviews this this pillar again?
It's difficult, and we've talked about this in the working group, but to separate out, sort of getting best practices defined, the pillars defined, and as opposed to the operational aspects, and you have to put them in, you have to put something in practice based on this. And so we've tried to stay out of the operational aspect and stick to, you know, practices definition, but it's really hard to communicate effectively and hold a conversation when you don't say, well, okay, so how, you know, let me take a practical application. So there's a couple of things that always concern me. One, in terms of the housing units, the 2,700, that plan that called for 2,700 units of permanent supported housing also called for 2,700 units of affordable housing. You need both, right? Because, you know, as George brought up, not everybody needs to go into supportive housing. There are people who are in just economic situations that, if you fix, they're quite capable of. And so, but even with that, that's only 900 units of housing added per year over the way this plan lays out over a 6-year period. And, you know, operationally, the recognition that, you know, in the 2019 point in time count, and I don't know what 2022 is, but we're going to find out shortly, we had approximately 2,600 people who were homeless for the first time in that prior 12 months. So you know, when you start to look at how these get put in play, if you have an inflow of 2,600, an outflow of 900, if you make those numbers, you know, you still have a 1,700 person gap who came in that you have no outflow for now. Not everyone will require housing, but, you know, if you, you know, take sort of the rough number that's been thrown around of 60% of them, well, that's still, you know, 1,560 people who, you know, require housing to 900 units, so you're still, you know, 600 or 700 units short. And so it's really hard to hold this conversation to even among ourselves, but the public, without talking about putting that effort in. And I think it came up early. The two ends of that overall flow, which is prevention, which is stopping it from happening, the housing, which is taking those people out and putting that, they make the difference. Everything in between is just moving them through the process. But if you can't reduce the inflow number and increase the outflow number, you continue to build up in shelters, and that's not an acceptable outcome for us. We need to figure out how we're going to make all of that work, right? You've got to balance that flow, or you won't make progress.
Yes, thank you. I know the clog in the shelter system is not having enough placement after shelter. And so I thank you for making that point. I know in my own experience that supportive services, just because you're there doesn't mean you have to have supportive services. What you need, even in the affordable housing projects that are not geared just for homeless people, in the scoring, if you want your, for example, tax credits being an example, you have to provide supportive services even for that kind of housing. And it's not as broad or extensive or as focused as you might find in the kind of housing that we're talking about with the so-called wraparound services. But you must have some services or you won't score enough points to get the funding. So I'm not sure I agree with that assumption that just because you are low income or poor that you need something by way of extra services. But it's there to be helpful if you do need it. And it's not just for us. So I think for the kind of homeless environment that we're talking about, and I think the housing thing is coming. It just takes time. I know we didn't talk about Project Home Key. We only talked about the trust. That's really separate apart from that. And that's creating a volume of additional housing. So we just have to keep plugging away at that. So are there other comments for the working group to consider? All right, now, are there other comments that commission members like to make about generally things that on our agenda or things we should consider? Do we have any comments from our public?
I have not received any requests from the public to speak.
Well, that comes to then adjournment. We did not achieve a quorum, so the action items will be put over. I'm sorry we did not initiate our new member. But we will we'll get you there. And thank you for your introduction. So with that, the next regular meeting will be held on June 15 at 1 p.m. In here, I think. I don't know why it would be anywhere else. It's a good spot. And with that, we are adjourned. Everybody stay safe and maybe we'll have a time conference.